Today on Vox Talks Economics, why populist messages cut through and what that means for sustainability. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics and another episode in our series based on the presentations at the first Hoffman Center CEPR Recipe Conference that was held at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. My name's Tim Phillips. In Europe and beyond, populists continue to gain ground. What messages are voters sending? And are politicians from other parties listening? And what does this mean for the difficult policy choices that we discuss on Vox Talks around climate change and sustainability? The work of Sergei Gouriev of London Business School and Catherine De Vries of Bocconi University has examined what drives support for populism and the implication for the social contract. They both join me now. Sergei, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you very much, Tim, for inviting me.
And Catherine, welcome as well.
Great to be here.
Sergei, in 2025, how much higher is the populist vote? How common is it to find populists that actually have power?
Indeed, there are different metrics of the rise of populism, and one is vote share, how many votes populists get in the elections, and the other one is indeed how many governments have populist members in the coalition or being led by populists. On both metrics, we are at all-time high. In the 21st century, the vote share of populist parties in Europe pretty much doubled, moving from 10-15% to 25-30%. That's a huge shift, which indeed brings some of those populists into governing coalitions or even leading the governing coalitions. The same way you can observe in different parts of the world, not just in Europe. And in the very influential paper by Funke, Shularik, and Trebisch, they find that almost a quarter of the world, or their sample of the world, which is 60 countries accounting for 95% of global GDP, about a quarter of countries are now run by populists. And this, of course, has very important implications for policies, for investment, for sustainability agenda. Now, one other element which people often forget is success of populism is also affecting non-populist parties. Several mainstream parties have dramatically shifted their policy agenda, trying to gain voters who would otherwise voted for populists. So it's not just populists come to power, but also mainstream parties are becoming more populist.
At this point, some of the people listening to this will be thinking, what do they actually mean by populism? As economists, we often start with policy choices. Sergei, in your presentation, I noted that you quoted definitions from political science, which focused on that division between the pure people and the corrupt elites that populists exploit. What is this definition useful for us?
Right, Tim. I think it's a very important point. I have a Greek author who always refers to Socrates, who said that beginning of wisdom is definition of terms. We cannot talk about populists before we define populism.
Yeah.
And in economics, until the recent rise of populism, which usually people date back to 2015-16, all the research would go back to definitions of Latin American populism in the second half of 20th century, which would be in terms of, as you rightly said, unsustainable macroeconomic policies. But now, indeed, a lot of new populism is not about macroeconomic policies, but about this definition that you just cited. Probably the most influential work on this was by Cass Moody and Cristobal Ravira-Kaltwasser, who crystallized this definition as a thin-centered ideology. So it's not about left or right wing. It's about the view of the world where the world is divided into corrupt elite and pure people. Now, it is also very important that in addition to this anti-elitist narrative, populists also use homogeneity. So Moody and Ravira-Kaltwasser always talk about two homogeneous groups, and pure people are homogeneous. And this is very important because it brings you a narrative which emphasizes anti-pluralism as well. It's not just anti-elitism, it's also anti-pluralism. And so these two features brought up by political scientists are very helpful to pin down the populist parties and politicians in the 21st century.
Catherine, if we're using this framing of a pure people and a corrupt elite who are in some ways controlling or exploiting them, what recent events can populists give a narrative to using this frame?
So we've seen a recent development of populist parties growing in size. And I think We saw post 2008, so the financial crisis, we actually saw in some countries left-wing populist parties. Greece was already mentioned, for example, as a case in point. But we also see the surge or the increase in migration flows into Western countries especially. We shouldn't overestimate them because there's actually more global south to global south migration. But overall, these type of surges have really allowed populists to say, well, this corrupt elite is out of touch, does not really know what the common people really would like, and allowed them to gain traction in their policy proposals, or at least in their anti-establishment rhetoric.
Sergei, when we're talking about the policy choices that populists make, as you point out, there isn't necessarily a useful right to V-left frame. Can we use this sort of definition to try and explain why policy choices are made, why populist policymakers act as they do?
It is very important indeed to refer to anti-immigration agenda, and I fully agree with Catherine. We had an influx of refugees into Europe in 2015-2016, which was actually unprecedented by European standards. We also have a secular trend in immigration. Globally, immigration remains at 3%. So the global share of foreign-born population is actually 3% of global population. This ratio has stayed stable for many decades, but actually the immigration into developed countries has increased dramatically by something like 5 percentage points. If you look at the share of foreign-born population in North America or Europe, and populists are using these issues and emphasize anti-immigration policy choices. Now, the other thing, of course, is populists are very much against checks and balances. I mentioned anti-pluralism. This is extremely important. Populists say, since all people are the same, we don't need more than one strong leader to represent them. And that, of course, is very bad for economics because investment climate, business climate relies on modern infrastructure of checks and balances, independent regulators, independent central banks, rule of law, which, of course, is maintained not through a will of one person, but through separation of powers. And therefore, populists are more often than not underperforming other leaders and actually are not able to deliver on their economic policy promises. And again, that paper by Funke, Shularek, and Trebesh that I just mentioned, 2023 paper published in American Economic Review, shows that populism costs you something like 1 percentage point of GDP per year. So if you compare populist leaders to counterfactual non-populist leaders' performance, populism is very costly for economics.
We spoke to Kevin O'Rourke in September 2023 about how some of the simplistic assumptions we make about populist ideas aren't supported by the historical record, and also how economists of the day have many times turned out to be on the wrong side of policy debates with those populists. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episode, Should History Change the Way We Think About Populism?
Catherine, I want to talk to you about some of your recent work, really based on how populists have exploited recent economic events and economic trends in Italy and the UK. In Italy, what policy did you focus on? What sort of outcomes were you looking for?
Yes, so what kind of events populists can exploit? We talked about kind of the 2008 crisis. And the 2008 crisis, of course, was a financial crisis, but in Europe very much became a debt crisis, which ultimately forced certain governments to employ austerity measures in their local economies. We've looked particularly in Italy at a law that the late Silvio Berlusconi, probably one of the populists in Europe that we had
a real original populist.
Absolutely. Implemented at the end of his reign. Of course, he was forced out in that particular crisis period, but he forced municipalities in Italy, and you have many, many, many small municipalities in Italy, to co-deliver public services. So what effectively happened, what we show in a paper in the American Journal of Political Science, if you can think about it, two small municipalities were now jointly providing public services. And because it's difficult to arrange or reorganize, what happened is that mayors effectively closed down the public services in one municipality and kept it open in another municipality.
Ah, right.
And that led to, let's say, half the amount of police patrolling the street, half the amount of garbage collection that you were used to before, less offices open where you could arrange, for example, your passports or these kinds of things. So really day-to-day experiences that people have with government to be reduced. And what we found in those municipalities that were affected by this reform, and for kind of more economic listeners, it's important that that reform had a population threshold. So we had a way to basically compare municipalities that had 4,099 inhabitants to 5,001 inhabitants. We could arguably say that they're not very different in many different aspects, but one was forced to implement this austerity measure and the other was not. And what we are able to show is that because of this reduction in public services, which we call public service deprivation, that that led to an uptake for populist right parties in those municipalities.
That's somewhat ironic because it was driven by a populist president doing this, but that deprivation in service was interpreted by the voting public as something that thinks, all right, I need to vote for someone who is represents me as one of the people.
Yeah, so I think there's two reasons for this. One is a kind of pull factor to the rhetoric of populist right parties, and also a push factor away from left-wing parties. So more poor distribution parties that are in there, right? You could think like, well, I experience austerity. Why don't I go to the guys that want to expand the state, right? So one thing is that often the push factor against the left is basically the left usually finances this kind of extension of public services either through taxes or through increases in debt. Well, Italy couldn't really increase its debt because it already had a debt overhang problem. So it advocated a lot of taxes. But imagine you're in a municipality, you've just been public servicely deprived, and now you should vote for a party that wants to increase your taxes. So let's say you get less services, right, for something, and you would have to pay more for it. So that was like a push factor away from these parties. Whereas the populist right parties basically say, well, we have a solution for this. We're not going to increase your taxes or increase debt. We're just going to reduce the number of people using services, i.e. these immigrants that live in your municipalities, they're disproportionately using services. And therefore, another quote unquote easy solution, I'm not saying it's the actual solution because it's not at all, and we can talk about that, but is to actually limit the amount of immigrants inside a municipality or coming into the country.
I also want to talk to you about the work that you've done in the UK, which is about the process of getting a doctor's appointment. As a British person, I'm smiling at this, but I'm not amused. For people who don't live in the UK, why?
The UK healthcare system is quite a unique healthcare system. It's a free at point of entry. So even China, right, has a combination of private elements and public elements in healthcare. That's actually much more generously publicly funded in the UK. But that can lead when the government has less money to spend. And we see that, of course, in many countries have increased debt post-COVID, but already post-2008 crisis. But also in Britain, the exacerbated effect of Brexit, which led to less growth in the UK system. The NHS was not as able to keep its service levels up. Other elements were also that you just see boomers retiring. So we also saw other reasons that led to less people being able to get a doctor's appointment. And the way that we try to measure that is looking at what's called general practitioner closures. So what you have in Britain, that if you want to enter the healthcare system, you can't just make an appointment with a specialist. You always have to go through what's called a general practitioner. And what happened in this period, because of the things that I outlined, so less money, retirements, less people that have been educated as general practitioners, less immigration into the UK, all led to GP practices closing. Those patients, of course, have to go somewhere. So they're reallocated to existing GP practices. And what happened in those GP practices, you can, of course, imagine, it's less likely that you're able to get a doctor's appointment. Those appointments are shorter, and also people are less satisfied with those appointments. So we have very detailed NHS administrative data where we can look at people who've been affected by these closures, reallocated to other GP practices, and they become much less satisfied with how the GPs are working because they're less likely to get an appointment and less satisfied about the appointment.
So do they become more likely to support populist politicians? Again, is there also this explanation through immigration for what's going on here?
Absolutely. We are looking at a period between 2013 and 2023. We unfortunately can't really, for two reasons, link this to actual voting data. What we link it to is vote intention data in panel surveys that we have. So this is declared support for populist right parties. And there's two reasons for this. So first, we had UK Independence Party, Brexit Party, and now Reform UK, right? they were not fielding candidates in every constituency, and that's because of the British system, right? It's a very high hurdle for a new party to enter. So what we're able to do is link those patients that have been affected by the GP closures to these surveys, because it's also very difficult to link them to the constituencies in votes. So you could say a cop-out, but at least it's a way to deal with it. We're looking at vote intention rather than actual vote. But what we see is that the vote intention for reform or every other party that Nigel Farage led in the British system since 2013 was increased. So in the Italian case, we find a 1.5% uptick for the populist right. And here we find about a 2% uptick that stables out over time. At a certain point, these grievances are, let's say, taken in, you know, like if there's no other effect, but we see a similar level of increase for the populist right. What economists often think about, maybe political scientists as well, does this come from demand, i.e. from the side of the voters, from their grievances, or from supply? That's more difficult to know because, of course, the rhetoric starts to strategically change as there's more demand, right? But what we're at least able to show is that people who've been affected by those GP closures, as well as the reform in Italy, become more concerned about immigration. They actually don't become more concerned about economic redistribution. So that probably tells you the similar story that they're not as drawn to left-wing sentiment. But equally, that parties like Reform or like the Brothers of Italy in Italy start talking about public services more as a zero-sum thing between the native population and the immigrant population. Note, this is, as I just explained, is not the reason why GPs actually closed. But people are basically saying, well, you cannot get a doctor's appointment because there's too much immigrants. And for example, Matteo Salvini in the Italian case said, I cannot keep your hospital open because I have to pay for the hotel of the immigrant. So this type of rhetoric just resonates more in areas where people have had negative experiences with public service delivery.
So, Gay, we're delighted to have you back in the UK now, but you will have noticed on the news here, this kind of rhetoric is very, very common at the moment. Is it always the case that immigration leads to dissatisfaction with immigration, which leads to rise in support for populists?
Let me answer a question after actually looping back to the UK voting after the global financial crisis. There is a complementary list of research to what Catherine was talking about by Timo Fetzer, which literally is called Austerity Causes Brexit, where he looks not at a medical public service provision, but at welfare benefits, which were cut in the austerity following the global financial crisis. And he shows that that has contributed to rising support for populist parties in the UK. Overall, global financial crisis was a unique event in recent history where you can actually see how populists would blame it on detached global elites located somewhere else, hurting us here in our village, in our small rural neighborhood. Going back to a question about immigration, it is actually interesting that the impact of increases in immigration are very nuanced. If you try to see whether higher immigration affects support for populists, the effect is actually nonlinear. And that depends on the size of the increase of immigration, the composition of immigrants, whether immigration is actually transit or settled. In 1950s, an important American social scientist, Gordon Allport, put forward this conjecture that if you talk to outside group like immigrants, if you work with them closely, if you cooperate on an equal footing, then you have empathy being developed, increasing. And so we see that in the episodes where immigration is relatively small as a share of native population, say 1%, 2% of native population, if there are successful integration efforts, actually the populist vote share goes down rather than up. But when you see that immigration is such that people understand that governments cannot manage it well, do not integrate immigrants, immigrants are actually many, and so people feel threatened, this is where populist vote share goes up.
And people massively overestimate the scale of immigration, don't they?
That's correct. Usually the research shows that people overestimate the scale of immigration by a factor of three. So as I said, the actual numbers are still growing. But people think that immigration is out of control in countries like UK and France. When you actually ask people and we look at actual numbers, the difference in public perception is a factor of three.
Now, one of the surprising election issues in the recent US election was the debate over the price of eggs, which isn't something that I ever thought I would see. But people are really talking about the inflation shock that they experience. So, Gay, you had something about this in your presentation. What argument are the populists making if they're talking about inflation?
Yes, this is also something that we've not seen for a while, right? Inflation in developed countries rising to levels of 6, 8, 9, or 10% year on year. And so the mainstream politicians didn't understand how to handle the narrative around that. And sometimes you can hear from the governments in the US or Europe saying, but we brought inflation down. It's now back down. Populists are saying, you're not talking about price of eggs. You're talking about rate of increase and CPI, whatever it is, right? And this is used to show that the global elites or the technocratic central bankers are completely detached from normal people who go to grocery store every day and care about price levels rather than price changes. This disconnected narrative, the narrative of central bankers, the narrative of an ordinary person and populist politician who tends to, or at least claims to represent ordinary people, even though I'm sure that many of the populist leaders don't go to grocery stores themselves every day, but people care about price levels. There is a recent paper by Stefani Stancheva which asks, if price levels have gone up, your wages also have gone up. Why do you think that the fact that wages actually caught up with price levels should make people unhappy? But the reason is people actually attribute the wage increases to their own effort, to their hard work to get a new job, to be promoted. And they say the nominal wage increases are because of my harder work. Price increases should be blamed on the government. And this is where, indeed, the disconnect between perceptions and reality may play a role. But I should say that maybe, and Stefani Stancheva's paper has some evidence on that, maybe people started to work harder to catch up with the price levels. And maybe there is a point that a recent inflation episode did undermine purchasing power per unit of effort. And in that sense, yes, every failure of mainstream politicians, as Catherine said when she was talking about public services provision, of course, creates fertile ground for populists.
While on one hand, it's easy to dismiss populists as unrealistic and making unsustainable promises, there is clearly a break in that social contract between people who are supporting populists and politicians, policymakers who are enacting these policies, and clearly they're not talking the same language. What do we have to do to revitalize this social contract, Catherine?
Well, I mean, the very simple answer, I think, if you talk to people, which I often also do in surveys and in real conversations, is that they just want the government to deliver in the way that Sergei was discussing, right? So there are serious problems that they think should be addressed more generally by governments. But the problem is that the room to maneuver for governments in a time of high debt, in a time of other responsibilities. So in Europe, for example, we have to start thinking about how to finance our defense. So that might mean that we have to spend less on other things, that it's also very difficult for governments to do that, right? So I think one way to revitalize the social contract would actually be for politicians to be quite open about these choices. And I think that's a very difficult message, but I think communication is what it has to start with. And then secondly, from that mandate that you could get for certain combinations of policies, then governments also have to be really on the ball to really put those through and make sure that they then also credit claim in the way that Sergei was saying. They really say, like, this is what I did as well. But I think the communication part post-financial crisis has actually been, unfortunately, not very good at sight of governments, where they are certain hard choices have not been explained very well and oftentimes have been moved over and suggested that we can just have it all. And I think that particular part of the discourse has to change.
I strongly agree. And I think communication is a very important piece of the puzzle. And I've done some research on this, showing that the rise of mobile broadband and social media has been an important contributor to the rise of populism. Catherine mentioned after global financial crisis, this is exactly the time when we have the great rollout of 3G, 4G, and 5G internet. And by the nature of social media advertising-based business model, they're better fit for shorter, simplistic, and negative messages. Messages criticizing status quo, messages rising dissatisfaction and anger and anxiety. So we shouldn't be surprised that unregulated social media actually provide a perfect platform for populist politicians. Catherine was also talking about the mandate. I think this is also an important piece of the puzzle. If we want to reconnect the perceived disconnected elite to the ordinary voter. There are several tools that we can use, and one of them is deliberative democracy, citizens' assemblies. If you want to push an agenda that initially may look like an agenda of the disconnected mainstream elites, one of the tools is to organize a citizens' assembly, randomly picked ordinary people, have them deliberate and discuss policy proposals, and then show that the final proposal that goes in front of the parliament is actually deliberated and produced by ordinary citizens and not by academics or experts. The other tool, which I think is very important, is ranked choice voting or systems like ranked choice voting. Not all electoral systems are the same. The rise of populism has been differentially proceeding in different countries with different electoral systems. And ranked choice voting helps you, again, to provide additional boost to centrist rather than radical extreme politicians. So there are opportunities for reform and given mandate to politicians who want to reconnect to the most important centrist voters rather than to pull and polarize the society. And as I said, social media have to be regulated. This is a dangerous platform that provides an opportunity for politicians who push negative messages.
So we have a particular policy problem that we need to solve at the moment, and I think that maybe the rise of populism might be making solving it more difficult. I'd be interested in your point of view on this. If we're thinking about climate policy, the sustainability debate, this is something that we see populists have opinions about. Catherine, what are their opinions? How do they frame this debate?
We luckily just published a review paper in Nature Human Behavior on exactly what we call the green backlash and populism, together with Itala Calantone, Valentina Bossetti, and Giorgio Mosto. Anyway, this really is a very important point. And I think that you have to understand populist radical right parties also as strategic political entrepreneurs that are seeking ways to make that argument that Sergei was talking about. So the kind of disconnected elite from the pure people, and climate is a particular element. They are framing the message as this is a expert-led oatmeal drinking elite that wants to change our entire lives, and they're doing it on the backs of ordinary people.
This climate change, it's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. If you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail.
There's a lot of inequality in some of the climate policies that have been rolled out. And this is very neatly exploited by populist radical right parties. But I say to my students, there is a 10-90% rule. There might be 10% evidence of the populist radical right diagnosis, but then it's 90% amplification in the way that Sergei was discussing on social media. So what you see is, yes, there's been hurts by certain car bans, certain not in my backyard elements where you have, for example, a windmill or something that is perceived as negative for a community. And radical right populist parties are really good at picking those things out, amplifying them, and then making it into a general discussion against elites. Also, some of the social movements that we've seen have made that element actually easier to do for the populist radical right. Mm-hmm. I have all the sympathy in the world with groups as Extinction Rebellion and so on, but they've been quite disruptive, you know, when it comes to, for example, museums or on streets or on railways. And that is also being exploited by the populist right. Look at those elitist groups that are making your life difficult.
Is the mainstream climate agenda being influenced by this populist influence?
Absolutely. And what Catherine said is exactly right. The climate and nature agenda is driven by expert consensus, right? So you need to trust the experts, and populists say that experts are part of the corrupt elite. It's not to say that we don't have a populist climate or nature parties. Actually, one of the most important Italian populist parties, Five Stars, you can say that they do have ecological component in their policy platform. Most populists are saying we have our living standards at stake here and now, while climate consensus is a consensus among scholars, and maybe it's not a consensus at all. Once you try to talk to voters in the US, many of them don't share this consensus. The other thing is, of course, the distrust in multilateral global institutions, which are so crucial for promoting a sustainability agenda. And again, for populists, these are detached, unelected global elites based in Brussels or Washington or wherever they are. By definition, by its nature, populist way of thinking, populist discourse is against very important players that push a sustainability agenda. And of course, what Catherine said about immigration also matters. I said that populist narrative is a anti-pluralism narrative. And of course, that part of sustainability agenda that focuses on gender equality, rights of global South, all of that is very much against what populists focus.
Imagine I'm one of these experts. I'm an oat milk drinking policymaker type person. I'm focused on climate change. I want to put one of these multilateral projects into operation, and it's probably going to redistribute wealth to the global South. How on earth am I going to sell this to the public?
Learned from the mistakes that have been made in the past.
Yeah.
There's clearly been some policies that had redistributive consequences which have not been compensated justly, and I think are perceived as unfair and unjust by certain parts of the population. So I think at least that we want to prevent moving forward.
I would advise to run something like a citizens' assembly, asking ordinary people to deliberate about how the sustainability agenda can be combined with taking care of you, not leaving you behind. We live now in a different world than 15 or 20 years ago. You can see temperatures above 40 degrees in European cities which don't have air conditioning. There is a scope for this, but you need to overcome this perceived disconnection of elites and people.
We know in meeting rooms all over Europe, there are policymakers and their advisors now mulling over this question. So I hope they're reading your research and I hope they're listening to your advice. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks, Tim.
And Sergey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
There's a long but very interesting reading list this week. First of all, Catherine's publications. Geographies of Discontent, Public Service Deprivation and the Rise of the Far Right in Italy. The authors Karamaschi, Rettel, Capelluti, De Vries. That was published in the American Journal of Political Science in 2024. Public Service Decline and Support for the Populist Right. Evidence from England's National Health Service. Authors Dixon, Hobolt, De Vries and Karamaschi. The Green Backlash and Right-Wing Populism, that was published in Nature Climate Change, number 15, 2025. Authors Bossetti, Colantoni, De Vries and Musto. For Sergei, The Political Economy of Populism, authors Guriev, Papayanu, published in the Journal of Economic Literature, volume 60, number 3, 2022. 3G Internet and Confidence in Government, and that's Guriev, Melnikov, Zoraskaya. That was in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, 136, number 4, 2021. We also had a Vox talk about that. It was called How the Mobile Internet Changed Politics. Gosh, that was in 2019. If you want to look on Vox EU, there's Evaluating Anti-Misinformation Policies on Social Media, Guriev, Henri, Marquis and Zoraskaya, that was from December 2023, and Public Service Deprivation and the Rise of the Far Right, Simone, Rettel, Capelluti and De Vries, January 2023.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, the battle to create standards for sustainability reporting.